You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Orson Bean was a ubiquitous presence on television when I was a kid. He was a star on Broadway and in the movies, but I saw him all the time on To Tell the Truth and The Match Game and What's My Line, as well as The Twilight Zone and The Ed Sullivan Show and The Tonight Show. He died in a traffic accident in February. I got to meet Orson Bean about a dozen years ago, and he made an appearance here on the show. It's a conversation that I treasure, and I'm pleased to share it with you tonight. I started by asking Orson Bean about the beginnings of his career as a stand-up comedian.
Well, it actually began when I was 6 years old and was given a $1 Gilbert magic set and never recovered. And I got to the point where, when I was 12 years old, that I was earning a little bit of money doing the magic act at the local Friday night church supper. And I went into the Army after high school and spent a year in Japan doing the magic act to get out of KP. Came back and immediately started working in nightclubs out of my hometown, which was Boston. In those days, there was hardly any television. There was Milton Berle on Tuesday night in the TV set in the bar, and there was Sid Caesar on Saturday night in the TV set in the bar, and there was maybe one family per neighborhood that had a TV set. So there were a lot of working-class nightclubs booked out of Boston. Like, there was a full year, actually, without repeating, of full weeks and split weeks, and I played famous places like the Copacabana in Nashua, New Hampshire. And I worked the Moose Club in Plymouth, Mass, and stuff like that, doing the magic act. And then went to Philly and worked the full year that there was out of that, and usually mafia owned joints out on the highway. Then I came to New York and walked into the Blue Angel, which was a famous supper club, and the boss was there, and he said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm a comedian." He said, "Say something funny." I said, "Belly button." He said, "All right, come back tonight. I'll put you on. I have a hunch." And I was immediately signed up for a several years contract and worked at the Blue Angel throughout the 50s, about 6 months out of the year, and then started doing Broadway shows, too.
Now, were you doing magic, or you were doing comedy? What was your act like?
I was doing a comedy magic act that little by little I had dropped the magic from, and it was mostly stand-up. And the only thing I had left was my routine called making a paper eucalyptus tree. And I did that in a show on Broadway called John Murray Anderson's Almanac, which was the last of the big featherhead reviews. Harry Belafonte was in it, and the English comedian Hermione Gingold, and the American comic Billy DeWolf, and we ran a year, and I did the last of my magic in that, and then just did the stand-up comedy from then on.
Now, was your act like, the iconoclastic comedians of the 50s, or more like the joke tellers of radio and
Broadway? It was somewhere in between. It wasn't anything like the comics up until that time, who had mostly worn black tie and done shtick in nightclubs. Mine was more cerebral, but it wasn't as political as Mort Saul. And I did routines like about my great-great-great-great-grandfather who fought in the American Revolution. He didn't actually fight in the Revolution. He was a bartender. My great-great-great-great-grandfather poured the shot heard around the world. Now, in those days, that got a laugh.
I laughed.
All right.
Did you always want to be a performer? I mean, you said you've been a magician since you were six, but were you thinking, I'll be a magician, I'll be Houdini, or did you want to be a...
No, I didn't want to be a magician, but I did always want to be a performer. I never wanted to be anything else. I was I was constantly getting trouble for cutting up in the classroom, driving the teacher crazier than I felt she was trying to drive me, and being sent down to the dean's office where he would say, "You again, what did you do this time?" And I did stuff like, there was a statue of Diana, the goddess of the moon, in the hallway of the school. And in the statue, she's reaching back to get an arrow out of her quiver. And I would stretch a gum between her lips and the hand, and just to annoy people. that was the extent of bad behavior in those days. It wasn't Uzi shotguns.
What performers did you admire as a kid?
Well, I worshipped Lenny Bruce, and I got to know Lenny Bruce, and I felt Lenny Bruce changed the entire face of stand-up comedy. He's known for talking dirty, but that really isn't what he did. The talking dirty was kind of just beside the point. He made a kind of a shorthand kind of speech that has since been adopted by every stand-up comic who knows nothing about Lenny Bruce. And I would just sit, and I worked in the same club as he did, never on the same gig, but he worked at the Village Vanguard in New York, which was basically a jazz and folk singing place, but used comics too. And he would work there, and I would work there sometimes, and I would always go to watch Lenny. He was the one that I really thought, you know, was incredible. And of course, I loved the real. I mean, as a kid, I worshipped Bob Hope in the movies, and then later on, when TV became more popular, I worshipped Jackie Gleason, and I got to work on Jackie Gleason's show a number of times and became an acquaintance of his. The first job that I had in the theater was sweeping up and opening the box office in the morning at a summer theater, and Bert Lahr came there, and I just would sit and watch Bert Lahr and marvel at his burlesque routines. And later on, I became a friend of Bert Lahr's and used to have lunch with him at Sardi's if we were both in shows on Broadway after the matinee, you know. And I got to know Groucho, and still cherish a lot of letters from Groucho. And I got to know Stan Laurel, and I'm actually one of the founders of something called the Sons of the Desert, which is to Laurel and Hardy what the Baker Street Irregulars are to Sherlock Holmes. It was very exciting, you know, to become friends with some of these people and to just kind of try to absorb what I could from them.
You were blacklisted at one point in your career. Is that true?
Yes, it was true. There was, during the blacklist, the Television Performers Union was so split because the lefties, the communists, would introduce legislation saying AFTRA goes on record as supporting the Trenton Six. The Trenton Six were six black kids who had been railroaded into prison on spurious charges of having raped a white girl or something. But that had nothing to do with the performers' union. So in those days, you would sit on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the union meetings to show what proclivities you had. And you had no choice but to do so, because if you sat on one side or the other, it was assumed you were a left-winger or a right-winger. So, of course, I sat on the left-hand side, even though I didn't like what was going on. And I decided to join a group that included Jack Parr and Charles Collingwood, the newscaster, and Tony Randall, and a group of people who formed something called the Middle of the Road Slate, which was an attempt to stop either the extreme left or the extreme right. The extreme right was supporting the red channels and the blacklist, and the extreme left was doing things like supporting the Trenton Six. So we won a great victory, and the New York Times wrote about us, and it was a great success, and I was elected first vice president of AFTRA, of the New York local of AFTRA. And for my pains, I was blacklisted. The way they were able to blacklist me was the fact that, incidentally, I was horny for a communist girl and had gone to some meetings. Many people became communists because they were horny for communist girls. I never became a member of the party, nor did I know what the hell I was talking about.
Yeah.
But
she had a black sweater on or something.
That's right, and it filled it out quite nicely. Or she did, anyway.
Yeah.
And so I overnight stopped being the hot young comic at CBS. They had made a pilot for the Orson Bean show, and I was a regular on the Ed Sullivan show, and I had hosted a 26-week run of a CBS variety show called The Blue Angel. And they had high hopes for me, as I did for myself. And Ed Sullivan himself called me up and said, "Have you heard about the new Red Channel thing?" And I said, "What?" I could feel the blood draining out of my face. He said, "Well, I'm afraid next Sunday's booking is out. I'll help you when I can."
Wow.
And a year went by in which I just couldn't work at all on TV. Luckily, I did a Broadway show that whole year called Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, so I kept working. And at the end of the year, Ed himself called me up and said, I think the pressure is off enough that I can book you. And he did. He booked me one more time, which was awful sweet of him. Ed Sullivan did many things that people don't know about. He was thought of as almost a kind of a joke, but he had the biggest show in America, the most powerful show in America. It was the American Idol of its day. And it may be even more so because there were only three networks. There weren't hundreds of things to watch as there are today. And one of the things that he did was, in those days, if you had a African-American performer on with you, I was told, don't touch that person. Don't even let your shoulder brush a black performer's shoulder because stations in the South will cut away. And they would. Well, Ed Sullivan had a wonderful performer named Pearl Bailey, a black singer, on. And he threw his arm around her and said, how you doing, Pearlie Mae? And all over the South, stations cut away. And then the phones lit up in the stations in Texas and Mississippi and Alabama. What happened to the Ed Sullivan show? Well, he touched a nigger. Well, but it's the Ed Sullivan show. And that was the end of that nonsense. And subsequently, I put the first black stand-up comic ever seen on network TV on the Tonight Show, where I had become the regular substitute host.
Really? Who was that performer?
Nipsey Russell. There had never been a black stand-up on. I don't say that to aggrandize myself. I just thought he was funny.
Was that when Parr was there or when Carson was there?
I substitute hosted over 100 times, beginning with Parr and continuing with Carson when the show came out of New York. And then after that, when Carson moved to L.A., I no longer substitute hosted. First of all, the show became much more important than it was, and they needed, you know, bigger names than me. But I went on guesting with Carson and appeared just under 100 times as a guest with him. In fact, when he retired, NBC released the top 10 most frequent guests, and I always tell people that I was just under, you'll pardon the expression, Charles Nelson Reilly.
The game show was a staple of television's early years. Unlike today's game shows, the panel shows of that era gave viewers a chance to while away a half hour with a rather elite group of intellectuals who played a not very serious parlor guessing game in which the contestant might win $50 if they fooled our panel. And my guest, Orson Bean, was a major part of this now mostly lost art form. Do you remember your first game show?
Yes, it was I've Got a Secret. And I didn't have a clue because playing games on a game show is a very specific skill. It's a minor one, but a specific one. Being a good game show panelist is like being a virtuoso of the kazoo. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and I lasted two shows, and they fired me.
Really?
Yeah, but I was on the very first I've Got a Secret, and the second, and that was all. And then after a while, they gave me another shot on a show called Password, and by that time, I had figured out how to do it. And then subsequently, I went on to Tell the Truth, and they kept me on there for 7 years, and I sat between Kitty Carlisle and Peggy Cass, whom I used to call the ward healer's daughter. Kitty was so elegant with her feather boas, and Peggy was just such a, you know, an Irish gutter snipe that it was wonderful casting. They cast the panel the way you would cast a sitcom. So it wasn't just people answering questions. It was like kind of an odd, dysfunctional family, whether it was What's My Line that was quite intellectual with publishers and things.
Mm-hmm.
John Daly hosted it, and
Bennett
Cerf, mm-hmm. the publisher, and there was Dorothy Kilgallen, whom America tuned in to love to hate. The people despised her. She was vile. I don't know if she was vile in person, but her persona was vile.
Did you know her? Did you meet her?
Very slightly, but I mean, you love to hate her the way you love to hate Simon Cowell on American Idol, you know.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're listening back to my interview with the late Orson Bean, the television personality, raconteur, and actor. Orson Bean died recently in a traffic accident in Los Angeles. Before the break, I was asking Orson Bean about some of the co-stars of the game shows on which he was so often a panelist.
Well, let me just ask you about some of those people. You mentioned Kitty Carlisle and Peggy Cass. I mean, I always enjoyed Peggy Cass. Was she a funny lady?
She was hilarious. And people always thought, because she did the game shows so long, that that's all she did. But actually, Peggy won a Tony on Broadway.
In Mame, wasn't it? Or Anti-Mame.
In Anti-Mame, the non-musical version, playing a character named Agnes Gooch. She was a wonderful actress.
I also remember a silly television series she had called The Hathaways, where she was the family of chimpanzees.
Yeah, she had the chimps. She hated the chimps. I worked with a chimp once, too. It wasn't a lot of fun. I love to watch them. Monkeys are hilarious.
Yes.
But they're not a lot of fun to work with.
And Kitty Carlisle, who you mentioned just passed
away.
Oh,
I adored Kitty. Less than a year ago, I got to roast her at the Met, Metropolitan Opera in New York. They called me and said they were going to honor her because she'd done so much work raising money for culture in New York State. And would I come in? And I did. And I got huge laughs in a packed Metropolitan Opera House roasting Kitty. It was so much fun. And still well into her 90s was doing a one-woman show that was really wonderful. I mean, the night that I roasted her, I just emceed it, but it was Julie Andrews and all of the great opera stars. And at the end of the night, she came out and planted her feet and blasted the place apart with a show tune, and then did a second one.
Wow.
And she claimed to be 92, but the obit said she was 96, so it's funny that even in your 90s, you shave a couple of years off if you're a dame.
Now I remember one of my favorite game shows that I know you were on was called Keep Talking.
Yeah.
There was a lot of clever comedians on that program. And what I'm wondering is, did those shows, especially the ones where you were expected to be spontaneously funny like that one, or Laugh Line, or The Match Game, did they employ writers?
No, they just employed writers for the non-professionals, you know, to help them with their statements and things. Goodson Todman was, which was the producer of all of the shows that I was ever on, Password, Tattletales, Match Game, and the rest of those. They were so scrupulously honest that if you came out onto the show and a person came out and said, I'm Irving Glutz and I climbed the Matterhorn. I'm Irving Glutz and I climbed the Matterhorn. I'm Irving. And you recognize one of the people from having passed him in a hall earlier that day and didn't even know if he was the real one or not, you were on your honor to disqualify yourself. And when the big scandal broke about 21 and the other show, that the $64,000 question, Mark Goodson, he had warned us all earlier than that. Those shows are fixed. And we said, how do you know? He said, because in real life, the attractive, interesting contestants don't stay on week after week after week. You wish they would, but they don't. And when he saw that they were doing so, he knew that the fix was in. Press got furious, I think, not because they felt that some great moral gulf had been crossed, but because they had been taken in. They had gone along with it. They had put Charles Van Doren on the cover of Time magazine. They had written up these people. And when they realized that they'd been taken in, that was what enraged them so. And they began attacking the two shows furiously. And I don't believe it was because they were so outraged. It's just that they were just so mad that they'd been suckered.
Did you have many occasions on To Tell the Truth in which you had to say, I disqualify myself?
No, almost never. I remember once or twice. It was a foolish rule because it really meant nothing. I mean, there were shows that employed writers, but I was never on them. The Heater Quigley shows, that was another group like Goodson Todman, like the Hollywood Squares, had jokes that theoretically would not affect the outcome. For instance, the guy in the middle, what was his name, that hilarious guy?
Paul Lind.
Paul Lind. They would give him a question like, what is a pullet? And Paul would say, a little show of affection. No, that was a scripted joke. And then he would go on to say, it's a chicken that's been fixed or something. And
right.
So that the contestant really wouldn't lose or win money. But that was a case where
the zingers were written.
Yeah,
though.
That was a great zinger, in my opinion, too. But we never had that on the Goodson Todmer shows.
So even on the Match Game, where there were some zingers occasionally, those were all spontaneously funny.
They were completely spontaneous. The Match Game was the first show that I think began the verbal moral decline in America by being able to say words like pee-pee and doo-doo and
right.
All of these kind of kiddie euphemisms for bawdy words, and it was a quick jump from. I was the first one that ever said the word horny on television. It was with Johnny.
What a great
Carson.
Distinction that is.
Well, yeah. I'm quite proud of it, actually. I said horny, and he looked at me, and I said, no, horny is a word that means when a young deer grows up and starts sprouting horns, that's when he becomes interested in lady deers, and that's horny. And he said, oh, then we can say horny. He said, horny, 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 horny. He said horny about 100 times that night. So I'm partially responsible for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, which is what's going on today when you can really say such vile things. Hardly a night goes by that David Letterman doesn't say I was in Central Park and a squirrel was playing with his nuts. And that's the mild stuff. In the 50s, I had jokes censored that I'm reading in the newspaper. This was on the old Blue Angel show, and I said, will Debbie say yes to Eddie Fisher? And I look up and say, depends on what the question is. They censored it. Too racy.
Too risque.
And we've gone from that to the stuff that you can say on cable TV. Certainly, there's simply no holds barred.
Do you think game shows hurt your acting career? I mean, did it become difficult for people to see you as someone other than Orson Bean?
Absolutely. When you've been on the game shows, they won't take you seriously. I made a conscious choice, but I don't really care. I mean, I made a choice early on that my career would never be a tiger that I had by the tail. I wanted to be famous enough to be recognized by head waiters and given a good table at the restaurant, but not so famous that it became an impediment to my privacy and having a good time. So,
is that how it's worked out?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it's worked out. I mean, I couldn't go onto Broadway and play King Lear, no matter how good I was, because they would say, the guy from To Tell the Truth is up there. And they wouldn't see the performance I was doing. They would see that. But I don't mind. I belong to a theater company here in L.A., and I can do whatever I want. I do a lot of Shaw. I do a lot of Pinter. I'm in rehearsal right now for a Sam Shepard play. And on top of that, a lot of my fans are dead, so they don't remember me for being famous for the wrong thing.
I guess the game shows live on the Game Show Network or whatever. But
yeah, well, that's true. It's a strange form of immortality.
Uh-huh.
I got a one-time check of $5 from Goodson Todman for all the shows I ever did.
Really?
Yes, because no one ever dreamed that there would be any use for those shows. But
they would ever
Mark
be
Goodson
repeated.
Taped them all.
Well, I saw recently that on my bookshelf here, on From the Bookshelf, and I have the DVD of the Best of the Match Game.
Yeah, they wanted me to be a permanent member of that instead of an occasional visitor, but Mark Goodson got mad at me because at the height of my career, I left New York and took my family and moved to Australia and left the panel of To Tell the Truth, and he never really forgave me. So, I was allowed to, guest on the shows, but even though they asked me to be a regular on the Match Game, he nixed me.
We're chatting with actor and author Orson Bean. So you left the country at the end of the 1960s. Was that for political reasons?
Yes, actually it was. I became convinced that the push from the left was going to be so strong. I mean, just a couple blocks from where I lived in Greenwich Village, the house on 11th Street blew up when the weathermen, mixed the dynamite wrong. And there were constant false alarms being put in, and so the fire trucks were constantly racing up and down my street. And I thought, the push from the left is so strong that the generals are going to crack down and there's going to be a military coup. And in my mind, I came to believe that it would happen on the 4th of July. So I booked passage for me and my family to go to Australia on July 3rd. At the last minute, I was invited to a swell 4th of July party, so I moved it up to the 5th. That's how nuts I was.
So your commitment was strong, but not that strong.
That's right. And a year went by, or a little over a year, and I realized, hey, America was fine, so I came home. And I'm glad I went, and I'm glad I came home.
Now, your cousin was Calvin Coolidge, the President of the United States. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, I know it very well. My grandfather's mother, and I loved my grandfather, who was the most important thing in my life, and his mom and Cal's mom were sisters. And when Cal's mom died, when my grandfather was 12, his aunt took him in, and my grandfather had to share his bedroom with him and his bicycle with him and his toys with him, and he never forgave Cal. He never liked him. He didn't like him when he became governor of Massachusetts, and didn't like him when he became president.
So is that why you were a lifelong Democrat, because Calvin Coolidge is a Republican?
Not necessarily. I think my father, my home was filled with politics. My father was one of the founders of the New England branch of the ACLU, and he was a member of the League Against War and Fascism, which changed its name overnight when Hitler and Stalin signed a pact, changed its name to the League for Peace and Democracy. It was nuts. My house was full of Trotskyites and Mensheviks and labor leaders, and we had the Scottsboro Boys there on a fundraiser, and I just thought it was all nuts. But you know, I grew up with it, and I became a big lefty, and then subsequently I've become much more conservative.
Have you?
So yes, I have.
What are your views now? Are you considering fleeing the country again, or are you?
Oh,
are you...
no, absolutely not. I've lived long enough now. I'm 78, and I've lived long enough to see the pendulum swing back and forth and back and forth, and I believe this is a centrist nation, and that's the greatness of it. And, you know, there was the McCarthy days when I was blacklisted, and then it swung too far to the left, and then back to the right, and then back to the left, and I see it continue to do that, and I just don't worry about it anymore.
Do you think you'll write any more books? Do you have
As a matter of fact, I have a book right now in the hands of a couple of different publishers, and I'm waiting to hear an answer about which one, if either will publish it, and otherwise I'll send it to some others.
You don't want to say what your book is about?
Sure, it's a fiction, but it's autobiographical. It's about a mentor of an older guy with a young guy, and it's about it's really about spiritual values. But the trouble is that it's full of bad language. So the Christian publishers won't go near it for that, and the mainstream publishers are afraid of its spirituality, and so it's kind of stuck in the middle. But I'll find one.
Are you a spiritual person?
Yeah, I am. I've become in late years a believer in God. I believe in evolution. I believe in the Big Bang theory. I just think that it's impossible that there wasn't somebody who lit the fuse.
But you're not in an organized religion, or are you?
Well, I go to church, but I'm not crazy about it. I believe in leaving out the middleman and dealing direct with the maker for big savings. Look, everybody believes in miracles. Christians believe that a supernatural being created life out of nothing. And atheists believe that matter and energy created itself from nothing, which violates the first law of thermodynamics. And atheists believe that life originated from non-life, which violates the law of biogenesis. So everybody believes in miracles. It's just, which miracles do you believe in? And I choose to believe in the set that makes me feel pretty good. And I find that atheists are kind of a sour lot. They're not happy campers. And Christians, even though a lot of them are kind of oakley-dokely and like Homer Simpson's neighbor,
yeah,
they seem a happier crew. So I choose my miracles to believe in.
Well, before you go, can you do some magic tricks for us?
Yeah. Here, pick a card.
Okay.
You got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it red or black?
It's red.
Queen of Diamonds.
Oh, my God, that's incredible.
<You see?
laughs> Did you see that at home, folks? Well, Orson Bean, it's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Bless your heart, Gary. It was good talking with you.
The late Orson Bean, recorded about a dozen years ago for From the Bookshelf. Shortly after this interview, Orson Bean joined the cast of the wildly successful Desperate Housewives. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We turn now to my friend Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She's the author of several books that we've talked about here on the show and that I love, and they include Mary Lou and Rhoda and Ted and All the Brilliant Minds Who Made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a Classic, Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything, and Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. And now she has generously offered to share all she knows about the business of books in a new podcast that she is producing along with her friend, author Kimberly Potts. The podcast is called Hashtag Authoring. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you decide to do a podcast? There's not enough podcasts.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, and the worst part is we already had one called Pop Literacy, and we decided to do another one mainly because we, Kim and I, often have these conversations at lunch. When we have these long lunches, we spend a lot of time discussing the crazy business of publishing. And I have these conversations with other author friends as well, and we just started thinking, what if people could hear them? We hoped that it would be a little bit helpful to people because we feel like the publishing business is very mysterious. You know, there's a little bit of reticence sometimes even on authors' parts to share wisdom with other people. I think it can feel really competitive sometimes. It's very stressful. Nobody wants to admit when they don't know things. Everybody wants to act like they're very successful all of the time and everything's great. And so we really thought that demystifying some of that would be helpful to people, in addition to which, it turns out when we started interviewing the people that we interview on the podcast, we learned a lot as well.
Well, it's, you know, I'm not an author, but I talk to authors all the time. And I found it really interesting even for people who aren't authors. That is, a lot of the stuff that you talked about, like you talked about the titling, for instance, of your books, and that you, that's not you necessarily.
Right. Right. This is something that I hoped would actually be, you know, like my dream was that there would even be people who might want to listen to it like that, who didn't necessarily want to publish a book or hadn't published a book, but would be interested in the process. People ask me questions all the time when I'm out, you know, on book tour and even just in general life, that everything does seem right, even things like a title or a cover, which is another thing that we talked about on an episode. These are all very mysterious things to people, and they don't realize how it happens. And the fact that, for instance, like you said, you know, if I go out on book tour and someone's asking me about the title, the answer might be something like, well, yeah, I wish it were something different, but this is what my publisher really wanted. And in the end, they're the ones in charge because they paid for it, that sort of thing. So I think there are just so many mysterious things about this whole thing, and it seems like to me the main things that people know about authors is we write books and we go on what people call book tour, which isn't really even true anymore. Most publishers don't really pay for that sort of thing, but those seem to be the only things that people know about being an author, you know, in the public. So we really love being able to talk about all of these things and show people how the sausage is made.
Well, I have found it very interesting, and there have been several episodes, and I hope you continue to do them. But how do you have the time? Aren't you writing a couple of books right now?
I mean, there's always, you can always find time somewhere. It's always a dance, but we do find that this is, it almost feels like part of our job in some ways. Like I said, we feel like we've learned a lot, and honestly, a huge thing that we need to do as authors is networking, and so this is kind of another way that we're doing that, and also what they call platform building, right? So getting your name out there, getting your work out there. But yes, I am. I have a book that's done that's coming out in April called Pop Star Goddesses, and then I'm working on another book called When Women Invented Television, which is due in June and will be out next year.
Pop Star Goddesses. Who would be interested in that, Jennifer? I don't understand.
I know that you will be, which is not something I anticipated because I'm clearly just sexist. But yeah, it's a fun little book. I'm really excited about it. It's an illustrated gift book, so it's really beautiful. There's illustrations done by an artist named Robin Merkel, and it has 35 goddesses, as I call them, you know, 35 female pop stars, and each one is, you know, there's a little essay, and I talk about sort of the qualities that I think that pop star embodies and, you know, that really gets people excited about them and the reasons that we really look up to them and want to emulate them in addition to just enjoying their music.
And I'm excited about the history book that you're talking about, how women invented television. What's it called?
When women invented television. Yeah.
And I knew you were doing something, but I didn't know exactly what it was. And that must be a lot more research intensive to write that one.
Yeah, it is. It's different for me. You know, it's not crazy, you know, given my other books, which are also about television history, but I have four main characters, so the way I've sort of had the elevator pitch about this is it's kind of hidden figures for early television. So this is a period between 1948 and 1955 when TV wasn't very lucrative yet. Radio was still kind of the main thing where people made money. And so women and people of color did a lot more than people think at that time. And because, you know, if it's not lucrative yet, the white men don't want to be there. So this was, you know, their shot to kind of get in there and make waves. And it really, a lot of women did foundational things in television at that time that we continue to build on till this day. So I have four main characters, and three of them are no longer with us and have been dead for quite some time, in fact. So it's very different for me because, you know, usually I'm interviewing people from a show like Sex and the City or Seinfeld who are clearly, you know, still around, and it's not that long ago. So this is a lot more archival research and stuff like that, which I've really enjoyed. It's very sort of peaceful and nerdy.
I can't wait to read it. It sounds fantastic. And just now, when you were talking about your elevator pitch and comparing it to Hidden Figures, that's something that you will cover on hashtag authoring, your podcast, about ways of pitching your book or talking about a book?
Yeah, that would be a great specific episode in the future. We have talked about, for instance, we had a great episode where we interviewed our agent, Lori Absmeyer, about, you know, being an agent and also how to come up with ideas that she'd be excited about that she can sell to editors. We also had an episode that was about writing a nonfiction book proposal, which is very much about, you know, figuring out your idea and selling it to publishers with your proposal. But then there's another layer of that, like you said, which is when you have to go out and talk about it to the public. And that's why I've developed that one pretty quick, because it's not something that's as clear as saying I wrote a book about Seinfeld, you know, and that throws people off, and you don't want to be one of those authors. Many of us do this when you're in the thick of your work. You really get very like, well, it's about this, but it's also about that, and you know, you have like all of these grand ideas about what your book's about. But when you're just talking to people in cocktail party conversation or on a podcast or that sort of thing, you have to be able to say quickly what it is. And this was a challenge a little bit for me on this book, because three of my four women are people that are not that well known, which was kind of the point. You know, it's supposed to be telling you something you may not know. And the fourth woman, by the way, that I feel like I keep being mysterious, the fourth woman who is both alive and quite famous is Betty White, who has been in the television business for as long as there has literally been television. And, you know, so she's kind of a good hook. Like, people get what I'm talking about when I talk about her. But the other three, who are Gertrude Berg, Erna Phillips, and Hazel Scott, some select people know, but a lot of people don't. And so that telling people that I'm writing a book about those women doesn't necessarily explain everything. So I had to come up with a way to say it very fast that people understood.
Both, two of those were blacklisted, right?
Yes, that's a huge theme in this book, is that kind of my idea is essentially that a conservative wave came through in the 50s, and that included, you know, white male patriarchy taking over television, and part of the way that they sort of knocked out these women who were in early television was via the blacklist. So Gertrude Berg was not technically blacklisted. She was, her television husband, Philip Loeb, was, and it really damaged her show that she had to, you know, she tried to fight for him, and that really kind of, even though the show went on after that, it was never the same and didn't get its rightful place in history because of it. She had a sitcom called The Goldbergs, a family sitcom. This was before even I Love Lucy. So hugely foundational. And Hazel Scott was, in fact, blacklisted. She was a very famous jazz musician at the time, who also was the first African-American to ever have a primetime national variety show of her own. And this should have been huge, but it was quickly curtailed by her being blacklisted.
Well, that sounds like some interesting stuff, not to mention your Pop Goddess book. And so I know, yes, I know you're going to be back very soon to talk about first the Pop Goddess and then the next one. But
absolutely.
Yes, but first, tell us again, where can we, you know, a lot of the people who listen to this program are listening to it on the radio, and they may not know a lot about podcasts and how they can find them. So how could people find hashtag authoring?
Well, a really easy way to do it is to go to authoringpodcast.com. And we've got actually all of the episodes up on the website there, and you can actually stream them right there, in order, out of order. They're all there. That's really easy. You can also listen wherever you listen to podcasts, and please feel free to subscribe as well. But it's really easy to do on our website.
Okay, everybody, go and do that right now. It's it's Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and her podcast is called Hashtag Authoring. And she's also authored several great books about television. Mary, Lou, and Rhoda and Ted, and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Sex in the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. They're all great books. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, thanks for dropping by, and we're going to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.